B English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iranian and Saudi foreign ministers sign a joint statement in Beijing to restore relations and start arrangements to reopening embassies and consulates. Iran's leader refutes Western countries' claim to be human rights advocates, asserting that they are basically enemies of those rights. Israeli forces fire stun grenades and rubber bullets as they attack Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound for a second day. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the foreign minister of Iran and Saudi Arabia have signed a joint statement in Beijing to give a boost to Riyadh-Tehran rapprochement efforts. Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud and Hossein Amir Abdullahian signed the joint statement following talks. Two countries have agreed to reopen embassies in each other's capital. The statement says Iran and Saudi Arabia will move toward restoring full ties. Consulate generals will also issue visas to nationals from the two countries, and the kingdom will ease the process for Umrah and Hajj pilgrimages. Riyadh and Tehran have also agreed to improve security and economic cooperation. The meeting between the top Saudi and Iranian diplomats is the first since the two countries signed a China-brokered deal on the resumption of ties. Our correspondent Gisu Mishahmadi is joining us now from the Chinese capital, Beijing, with all the latest. Gisu, over to you.
As we've been telling you since the early hours this morning, that this is a very historic moment for the two countries, Iran and Saudi Arabia, resuming their relations after 7 years. Now I am joined by the foreign ministry spokesman to tell us what was happening behind those closed doors out of which I was talking to you. And of course, we want to find out exactly what was going on and what the atmosphere was. So thank you very much, Mr. Kanoni, for joining us here on Press TV. Tell us exactly how the negotiations went. Was it as planned? What was the significance of this meeting?
Thank you very much. Today, fortunately, in Beijing, we saw a very positive development and a very significant one in Iranian-Saudi relations. Following a previous agreement between the two countries with regards to the resumption of talks, several rounds of phone talks had been held between the foreign ministers of the two countries. Today in Beijing, we witnessed the first official meeting between the foreign ministers of Iran and Saudi Arabia. And there were two meetings, one behind closed doors and one an on-camera meeting. And we saw very positive talks, very constructive negotiations between the two sides. Accordingly, the two sides stressed that, actually they said that they have consensus on that, and they said that from today they resume their official ties. From today, then they decided to exchange some delegations between the two countries in the as soon as possible, and we will see that in the coming days. Actually, such developments will take place. Actually, technical teams will be present, will visit the capitals of both countries, and more talks will be held, and the embassies of both countries will be reopened soon in order to. Actually, as the leaders of both countries are willing to and are have agreed over that, there are some issues, including an agreement between the two countries, a cooperation between the two countries, and the two countries agreed to make those agreements operational. State and private sector teams will also. So be exchanged between the two countries in order to further boost ties in different areas, including trade. And within the same framework, they decided to, within the framework of technical cooperation between relevant bodies of both countries, between Iran and Saudi Arabia. They agreed to establish relations between those bodies. The two sides emphasized the importance of stability in the region and security in the region, and that the two countries, Iran and Saudi Arabia, should help boost stability and security in the region, make joint efforts, and they also emphasize joint efforts by regional countries in that regard. As for cooperation between the two countries, they stressed the need to boost trade and economic ties between the two sides. Also, regarding the facilitation of the issuance of visas between the two countries, this was also on the agenda of the talks, and finally, they issued a joint statement following the talks. And this statement reiterates the common will between the two countries to resume ties and the resumption of cordial ties between the two countries.
A very bright future in the Persian Gulf region, very strong ties between regional countries, particularly Iran and Saudi Arabia, key players of the region. And of course, as I said before, I've been talking to pundits, and everyone believes that this is a major step towards a stronger regional alliance in the Persian Gulf.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has debunked the West's claim to be advocating human rights. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says Western states are basically enemies of those rights. Ayatollah Khamenei added that despite its rights claims, the West has been the main supporter of Daesh terrorists, regional dictators, and Israel's crimes against Palestinians. He added that the West also supported assassination of Iran's faithful youths during the recent riots in the Iranian capital. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that imposing sanctions, including bans on delivery of medicine and vaccines, was another means by which the West has been attacking Iran. The leader said the West's claim to be supporting the rights and freedom of Iranian women is nothing but a lie. He was speaking in a meeting with Iranian poets on the occasion of the fasting month of Ramadan. Israeli forces have once again attacked Palestinian worshippers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The regime's forces entered the compound and tried to evacuate worshippers, firing stun grenades and rubber bullets. At least 20 Palestinians were injured. This was the second attack in less than 24 hours. On Wednesday, hundreds of Palestinians were injured and hundreds more detained after the regime's forces stormed Al-Aqsa during the evening Ramadan prayers. The brutal attack sparked clashes in Ghalandia and Shafat refugee camps. In the occupied West Bank, in response to Israeli aggression, resistance groups also fired rockets toward the occupied territories. The UN Security Council will hold an emergency meeting at the request of Jordan and Palestine to discuss Israel's attacks on Al-Aqsa, and Palestinians, United Arab Emirates, and China backed Jordan's request for the UNSC meeting. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says Israeli forces have vandalized the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and beaten up Palestinians offering prayers there.
For the second consecutive day, Israeli forces unfortunately succeeded to bring out the worshippers from the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex. What happened last night, Wednesday, after the Isha, the Taraweeh prayers, thousands of Palestinian worshippers remained and stayed at the Al-Aqsa and its complex for i'tikaf, to continue performing prayers and reciting the Holy Quran during the holy month of Ramadan. When they were surprised by Israeli forces, Israeli police raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque, attacking people, hitting and beating people with batons, smashing the windows and destroying the doors of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to bring out the worshippers. The Israeli military claims that those are barricading themselves inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The question that should be asked is why worshippers would be barricading themselves. They are remaining in Al-Aqsa Mosque to perform the prayers.
Condemnations are pouring in from across the globe following Israeli forces' brutal attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Iran said the desecration of the mosque was marked by, quote, harrowing scenes, which were the result of the so-called rights advocates' silence toward Tel Aviv's crimes. The spokesman for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the UN chief was shocked and appalled by images of Israeli forces beating people at Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Arab League also categorically condemned the regime's acts of aggression. It decried all attempts by Israel to change the historic and legal status of Al-Aqsa. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas vowed retaliation for Israel's terrorizing worshippers. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement, for its part, said the retaliatory rocket attacks following Israeli raids were just an initial warning message. Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip have held a protest rally to condemn the Israeli assault on Muslim worshippers inside Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Al-Quds. Ola Alassi reports from Gaza.
A vigil has been held in the north of the Gaza Strip, condemning the Israeli brutal attack against Palestinian worshippers who were peacefully observing the holy month of Ramadan. Israeli forces forcibly evicted the worshippers in Al-Qibla Prayer Hall and Al-Aqsa Mosque using stun grenades and tear gas. They left a trail of destruction in the mosque and its facilities. The Israeli troops also beat worshippers with batons and rifles, causing hundreds of injuries to them. The Palestinian Commission of Detainees Affairs estimated that over 400 Palestinian men have been arrested.
We call on the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds to intensify their presence in the Holy Mosque. And we call on the Arab and Islamic world to hold marches to support the Palestinians against the stark violation of the mosque sanctity.
Hundreds of Palestinians took to the streets in the occupied West Bank to condemn the Israeli assault at the Holy Mosque. Clashes erupted between Palestinians and Israeli forces at checkpoints and army posts.
What happened last night is a crime and a violation to the sanctity of the Holy Mosque. The Palestinian resistance response from Gaza comes simultaneously with the confrontations in the West Bank is a clear evidence that the Palestinians across Palestine are united against the Israeli aggression.
Palestinian resistance groups fired a barrage of rockets from Gaza toward Israel in response to the violent Israeli assault in Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli warplanes attacked multiple sites in Gaza, striking military sites in the north, center, and west of the Gaza Strip.
If the Israeli occupation did not read the Palestinian resistance message, the Palestinian resistance factions are ready to respond in ways that are unpredicted. The Palestinian resistance response this morning is an evidence of its readiness to defend the holy sites.
Dozens of demonstrators took to the streets in Gaza burning tires to protest the Israeli attack in occupied Al-Quds. Earlier, hundreds took to the street in rallies across the Gaza Strip after the night to prayer to condemn the Israeli assault on the worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. People from all walks of life took to the streets after the Tarawih prayer, rejecting the Tel Aviv's crimes and the Holy Mosque.
Palestinians will never remain silent in the face of these atrocities and violation inside the Holy Mosque and its courtyards. The Israeli occupation is responsible for this violation.
The incident drew a sharp reaction from the Arab countries, issuing statements to condemn Wednesday incidents amid international mediations to de-escalate the situation. Tensions are already high in the occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank for months. There are fears of further violence as important religious festivals, the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan and the Jewish Passover, converge. Al-Asi, Gaza.
French workers are holding yet another day of protests and strikes over pension reforms after talks between the government and unions ended without a breakthrough. Unions called for fresh actions amid growing anger at the government's decision to raise the maximum retirement age to 64. This is the 11th such mobilization since protests started in mid-January against the overhaul. The latest action has caused travel chaos in Paris. About 20% of school teachers are also expected to join the strike. The unions have vowed not to back down after their talks with Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne failed on Wednesday. The government forced the reform bill through Parliament without a vote last month. The Constitutional Council will give its verdict next week if the Council approves the bill. President Emmanuel Macron will sign it into law. Finland has officially become the 31st member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The Kremlin has considered the move as a threat and warned of countermeasures. Moscow has time and again voiced its concerns about NATO's expansionism. Therefore, Finland's joining the U.S.-led military alliance and the alliance's expansion could be deemed as a clear act of provocation.
Finland has officially joined the U.S.-led NATO despite repeated warnings from Russia, which vowed countermeasures and plans to bolster its military capacity in its western and northwestern regions near the border with the Nordic country if the alliance deploys any additional troops or equipment to its new member. At the headquarters of the NATO in Brussels, a ceremony was held on Tuesday, during which NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, Finnish Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto, and the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken completed the final formalities of Finland's accession to the U.S.-led transatlantic military alliance in front of the media. Separately, Finland's President Sauli Niinisto also confirmed his country's membership in a statement. He said Finland has today become a member of the defense alliance NATO. The era of military non-alignment in our history has come to an end. A new era begins. Niinisto added, each country maximizes its own security, so does Finland. At the same time, NATO membership strengthens our international position and room for maneuver. As a partner, we have long actively participated in NATO activities. In the future, Finland will make a contribution to NATO's collective deterrence and defense. In an apparent reference to Russia's deep concerns regarding NATO's expansion, the Finnish president stressed that Finland's membership is not targeted against anyone, nor does it change the foundations or objectives of Finland's foreign and security policy. He described Finland as a stable and predictable Nordic country that seeks peaceful resolution of disputes. Russia's reaction to the new membership was strong, as the Kremlin warned that Finland's NATO membership would force Moscow to take countermeasures. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "The Kremlin believes that this is another aggravation of the situation. The NATO expansion is an encroachment on our security, the interests of the Russian Federation. This is exactly how we perceive it. We will take countermeasures to ensure our own tactical and strategic security." He also stressed that the countermeasures that Moscow deems necessary would be taken, adding that the Russian armed forces would report on their response to NATO actions in the Nordic country. Finland's accession to NATO adds one of Western Europe's most potent wartime militaries to the U.S.-led military alliance, as well as the Nordic countries' intelligence and border surveillance abilities. Helsinki brings with it a well-equipped and trained active armed force of about 30,000. It can also call on 250,000 reserves. Finland's accession also doubles the length of NATO's border with Russia. The membership would guarantee the country's access to the resources of the entire alliance in the event of attack.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The average American lifespan keeps getting shorter, even as comparably rich countries rebound and recover after COVID-19. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Nature, U.S. life expectancy has dropped for the second year in a row, down to 76 years. Plus, an antibody patent row could have far-reaching impacts on biotech and the state of brain-computer interfaces. 10 years after a landmark study on life expectancy in the United States, the news is grim. The number of years a person can expect to live has dropped for the second year in a row, down to 76 years. Maternal mortality and child mortality are rising in the U.S., and many of the myriad causes of shortened life expectancy are more likely to affect younger people. Death from guns, cars, and opioid, for example. One thing that might help, say public health researchers, is for people to open their minds to what works in other countries. You look at these healthier countries, they are free countries. They are not banning delicious foods. They are not chaining people to treadmills, notes Ravi Saheni, a co-author of a landmark report. Also, RT noted, recently National Public Radio, NPR, in the U.S. published a story titled Live Free and Die, the saddest state of U.S. life expectancy, that explored the great divide between the United States and peer countries on life expectancy. While most countries experienced a dip during the COVID-19 pandemic and rebounded after vaccines and other treatments were rolled out, American life expectancy has essentially fallen off a cliff and never came back. A graph published by NPR is shocking. It shows that U.S. life expectancy is lower than in Cuba or Lebanon. The number has been known since just before Christmas, when health officials announced that the country's life expectancy had dropped starkly after a second year in a row to 76 years. However, last week, more bad news arrived after the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, announced that maternal mortality in the country reached a high in 2021. And another paper in the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, found rising mortality rates among U.S. children and adolescents. This means you can't blame COVID-19 exclusively for the drop in U.S. life expectancy and assume it will jump right back up as soon as the pandemic is finally dealt with. The rate of maternal deaths in 2021 was 32.9 deaths per 100,000 live births, which is more than 10 times higher than some other high-income countries, including Australia, Austria, Japan, and Spain, which all had rates between 2 and 3 deaths per 100,000 in 2020. Regarding children's increased mortality rate, Stephen Wolf, the lead author of JAMAA paper and director emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, put it quite succinctly. "This is the first time in my career that I have ever seen an increase in pediatric mortality. It's always been declining in the United States for as long as I can remember. Now it's increasing at a magnitude that has not occurred for at least half a century." The paper notes that this goes far beyond the stereotypes of Americans having poor eating habits or other unhealthy addictions. It found that American children are less likely to live to age 5 than children in other high-income countries. It continues stating that even Americans with healthy behaviors, for example, those who are not obese and do not smoke, appear to have higher disease rates than their peers in other countries. The researchers catalogued what they described as the U.S. health disadvantage, which essentially means that just living in the country is worse for your health and makes you die younger than in other comparable countries. Given the recent environmental disaster in Ohio, where droves of carcinogenic chemicals were allowed to burn freely in the air and deposit into the soil, this may also be part of the explanation. The incident also has impacted the major metropolitan area and hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio. Additionally, right now, residents of one of the largest American cities, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, are being told to drink bottled water because more than 8,000 gallons of latex finishing solution spilled into Otter Creek in Bristol near Philadelphia on March 24th. Some of the chemicals in the spill include butyl acrylate, just as those released in Ohio. It seems that such environmental disasters are becoming more frequent. Perhaps the most baffling statistic, at least for a non-American, is that since 2020, gunfire has been the leading cause of death for children and young adults in the U.S., surpassing even car crashes, which had previously topped the list. Almost 20% of all deaths of Americans aged 1 to 18 who died in the past 3 years were gun-related. Compared to other countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, the United States is the only country where guns are the leading cause of death for people in this age bracket. No other nation even has it in the top four. Be it the stereotypical bad eating habits and endemic obesity, interestingly, frequent environmental disasters, or the scourge of gun violence, there is indeed a disadvantage to simply existing in the U.S. As a consequence, more and more young Americans are looking to settle down in other countries rather than wait for lawmakers to actually do something to protect people from these dangers. In the end, whether it's Republicans sounding the alarm over the opioid crisis and rising drug deaths, or Democrats shouting themselves hoarse about the need for stricter gun laws to curb the disastrous gun death stats, what most of them are interested in, first and foremost, is scoring points against each other. Actually, helping their constituents comes as an afterthought.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli police beating Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque and outlets. The Israeli police said that they had entered to dislodge, quote, agitators, but that could not be further from the truth. Hamas has called this an unprecedented crime, and the Arab League, at the request of Jordan, held an emergency meeting in a show of Arab unity against Tel Aviv. The Arab League urged the UN Security Council to take action to stop such Israeli aggression, which is aimed at changing the status quo of the holy site. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Al-Aqsa Mosque desecration by Israel, why Israel prevents Palestinian prayers in this Muslim holy site, and a look at the bigger picture when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Saad Nimr is a professor of political science who joins us from Birzeit University. Also joining us is Charlotte Cates, international coordinator at Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Saad Nimr. Obviously, this was words fail to describe the way that these Palestinians were treated at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But first, I'll start with a general question. What gives Israel the right to attack and to desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque, which included the beating of these worshippers?
It's quite clear that what would give the Israeli the right to do that, it's the nature of the coalition of Netanyahu's government. We have to remember that two members, two parties in the coalition of this government are the religious Zionist parties, who are pressurizing, you know, Netanyahu over lots of other things, and Netanyahu could not do anything about it. Because otherwise he will lose his position as a prime minister. So this is a kind of a work of the right, very right fascist wing in Israel, which is like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who wanted to, and they are both settlers, and they want the settlers to get into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ben-Gvir's statement lately, he said that Al-Aqsa Mosque is not only for the Muslims, it's for even also for the Jews, which is quite clear about, you know, the partition of the Al-Aqsa Mosque between the Palestinians and the Jews and or the Israelis in such case. And now they are calling for a huge incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the coming few days because it's the Easter feast for the Jews in nowadays. And it started tomorrow, and they want a huge amount of settlers to get into Al-Aqsa Mosque. So because of all that, the attack last night was to get all the Palestinian prayers out of the mosque because they want to do the incursion on the, in the morning, and they don't want anyone to be there. Last night, there was more than 70,000 Palestinian prayers for the last prayers, and wait, and some of them were waiting also in the mosque for the morning prayers, and sure, those who were attacked by the Israeli police.
Well, Charlotte Cates, we need to, have you tell us or differentiate for us the narrative here, because what the media, many of the Western media, is claiming is that Israeli forces have clashed with Palestinian worshippers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Well, that's not the way that it's gone down. I mean, the scenes speak for themselves, and the facts speak for themselves. You have Palestinian, they're worshippers, they go inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and then you have the security forces beating them. And these were some violent scenes. These beatings were quite cruel. I mean, they were quite violent. They were very graphic. I don't know if you've seen the videos. I'm sure you have. Beating them on the head. This is one eyewitness. They attacked the people, beating them on the head with sticks. People fainted. People suffocated. People were bleeding. And then they started arresting them, which we have the count to be 500. So this narrative for there to be clashes is a false one, isn't it?
This depiction by the media is clearly a reflection of the way that Western corporate mainstream media attempts to distract from the issue that there is clearly an oppressed people who are defending themselves and an oppressor that is using the most brutal attacks on people who are praying and remaining in Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. And there's an attempt to forcibly remove Palestinian worshipers from the mosque in order to make way for violent fanatic settlers to invade and not just perform rites in Al-Aqsa Mosque, but threaten its destruction. So there's no equal balance here. The issue itself is just reflected in what we see in those horrible scenes from those videos, is that very fundamental inequality where you have people practicing their right to their religious beliefs on their own land and being assaulted brutally by a colonial occupier that wants to strip even that basic humanity from Palestinians and is failing to do so. There were hundreds of Palestinians thrown onto the ground of the mosque, rounded up. Palestinians that were kneeling to pray were forcibly assaulted by occupation police forces in order so that a few fanatical settlers could enter into Al-Aqsa Mosque and threaten its destruction. What on earth does this represent other than the most brutal and bare form of colonialism before the world? While there has been an increasing number of condemnations, because how can you look at that video and not see what the reality is? Unfortunately, the United States, the European Union, Canada continue to sell weapons to Israel, continue to provide it with funds, continue to provide it with arms, and to continue to enable these colonial crimes to continue on a daily basis.
Yeah, perhaps you, of all people, I'm sure, can explain to us, Nimr, what is the, the rule of law when it comes to praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in terms of Muslims? If you can give us a little bit of a background here, because it's supposed to be only for Muslims, but we understand that if you're a foreigner visiting Israel and you go to Al-Quds, you could enter the mosque. And Palestinians can't enter their own mosque as a Muslim. So tell us what restrictions Israel has placed. Give us a little bit of a background information here.
Absolutely right. But I would like first to add just one sentence for the last question. The number of the soldiers and the police forces who entered Al-Aqsa Mosque was huge, which means that it was prepared beforehand. It doesn't mean that there was a clash. They were preparing for this session of attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It was not clash as it was viewed in some of the media, but we know that the media is a hypocrite and a double standard. However, for the laws about how to go into Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we are talking about Ramadan now, and especially with the thousands and thousands of Palestinians from everywhere would like to get in. First of all, for the Palestinian Jerusalemite, they can go at any time because it's any age, because they are Jerusalemite and they have the ID which is indicating that they are from Jerusalem. Now, for the Palestinians from outside Jerusalem, they laws on the roadblocks, which they block the Palestinians. For men, it should be 55 years old, and women over 40 years old, to let them enter to Jerusalem and consequently to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that's only on Fridays. Other days, no, they are not allowed to. Now, the other set of laws concerning Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Aqsa Mosque is closed for the Palestinians totally from 7 o'clock in the morning till almost 12 in the afternoon or in the noon, because this time is made for the settlers to go into the mosque. And they try to choose the time where there is no prayer between the morning prayer and the dhuhr prayer, the lunch prayer. And then for the foreigners, they can get during that time also with the Israelis or with the settlers at the same time. They can visit Al-Aqsa Mosque unless they are coming with Palestinians, and in such case they can go through the other gates. But this gate, which is Al-Magharbi gate, it's designated only for the settlers and it's used only by the settlers and some of the foreigners. So foreigners, yes, could come at any time, not only to Al-Aqsa Mosque, even to Jerusalem. And I've so many times have said that even to my students, international students, that you can go to Jerusalem whenever you like as a foreigner. And I live only 14 kilometers from Jerusalem and I can't get there. So it's quite, you know, these laws concerning the Palestinians to pray or to go to Jerusalem or to be in the city. What's the plan by the Israelis and this fascist government is to prevent and to isolate Jerusalem from its environment, which is the Palestinian cities and villages around Jerusalem, which now became behind the wall and it's not considered as part of Jerusalem or part of the district.
Can you hold on there? So let me go to Charlotte Cates. Charlotte Cates, we're looking at, obviously, this to be in conjunction with the beginning of Passover. And one of the things that has been called by these settlers is quite actually, I'm not too sure, surprising or shocking. They have asked, and I'm wondering why, from you, if you can explain to us why this is so controversial, because they have said that they have allocated sums of money. This movement by the name of the Return to the Mount, they've allocated sums of money as rewards for settlers who attempt to make a sacrifice at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Passover, and it's around $7,000, which would be paid, and $700 if they are arrested inside of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Can you explain to us what's going on in their head, and why is this controversial?
Well, first of all, it says a lot that in order to supposedly perform a religious rite, which would ostensibly be performed out of dedication to God, these organizations are offering to pay people $7,000 in order to do it, which is a significant sum of money. And what that indicates is that the purpose of this is not some form of religious worship of God, but of a deliberate planned criminal provocation targeting the Palestinian people, targeting the holy sites of the Palestinian people, and specifically targeting Muslims in general. The purpose is to claim through this religious expression some sort of alleged Jewish dominion or recreation of the temple on the grounds of Al-Aqsa Mosque. But what this fundamentally is, beyond the religious trappings, is one of the barest and most obvious and blatant forms of colonial assault on the Palestinian people. This is not about freedom of religion or freedom of worship. If it were, there wouldn't be any need for the $7,000 bribe. What this is instead is an attempt to essentially hire mercenaries to attack the Palestinian people from among the settler forces. Because when we talk about settlers and what they are, really what we're talking about are groups of paramilitaries, heavily armed individuals carrying out the violence of colonialism against the Palestinian people, whether this is invading holy sites, whether this is attempting to destroy homes, whether this is uprooting olive trees and burning crops, all of these are these forms of paramilitary settler violence that operate hand in hand with the official state violence of the occupation army.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, one of the other goals, which is one of the major ones here, Saad, I'll never correct me if I'm wrong, is that it wants to take away the Islamic identity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I think that's one of the goals that Israel does have. And, of course, the settlers are very much into doing that. It is said that that is one of the aims here. Tell us the different ways that we've seen this happen in terms of taking away the Islamic identity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Yes, absolutely. That's what happened in Hebron with the Ibrahimi Mosque. When the settler insisted, and after the massacre of 1994, when they divided the Ibrahimi Mosque into two parts, part for Jews and part for Muslims, though the mosque is an Islamic site. And now it's happening again in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the same way. Al-Aqsa consists of 144 square dunams. In total, all of it. Now the settlers claiming, you know, a part of it, and they think or they believe, which is, you know, not true at all, that the Temple Mount, it's a Temple Mount, and the temple was there, whereas the Dome of the Rock now is there. And even since 1967, after the occupation of East Jerusalem, the Israelis started the try to find any evidence to prove this stupid story, which was not at all proven. They already dug more than 31 tunnels underneath Al-Aqsa and the old city of Jerusalem in different directions and in different elevation in order to find any shred of evidence to prove that the temple was there, and they couldn't find anything at all. However, they are still insisting on their part of the story that the temple was there, and they want to claim part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque as, you know, theirs, so they can divide Al-Aqsa Mosque not only time-wise, as it happens now, but also place-wise. So they are demanding the area called Bab al-Rahmeh, and the mosque there, or the area there, which the Palestinians do pray in that area. It was closed for a while by the Israelis, and the intention were, after closing it, to open it only for Jews. But the Palestinian force opening it, and now they are using it as part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque to pray. Now, the settlers wanted this area to start there and to bring their, you know, even whatever sacrifices and other things, and start doing some rituals which is related to Judaism. And in this case, they will claim part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, we know that this extreme Israeli minister, Ben-Gvir, Charlotte Cates, which needs to be brought into the conversation, he not only has been convicted for racist incitement against, obviously, Palestinians and Arabs, he also supports terrorism. And he has expressed support for Baruch Goldstein, who was an Israeli-American, maybe you know about this, who killed 29 Palestinians at the Ibrahimi Mosque back in 1944. I mention this because Saad Nim there mentioned the Ibrahimi Mosque, and I figured I could bring and introduce Ben-Gvir and his character into this and ask you the role that he's playing now when it comes to not only the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which he obviously wants for the Jews or the Israelis, but he wants but it stands towards Palestinians. Maybe you can give us an insight into that.
Well, Ben-Gvir has made a career and is attempting to build a political empire on the backs of the most blatant racism, genocidal rhetoric, construction of apartheid settler colonialism against the Palestinian people. I mean, this is someone who doesn't have the slightest hesitation about calling for another Nakba. And essentially, you know, that's what Ben-Gvir wants to do in this position is, you know, he's just been given this new so-called National Guard force, which is essentially another, he's already in charge of the occupation police, where we just heard yesterday these release tapes of the head of the occupation police declaring that, quote unquote, Arabs murder each other and engaging in this blatant anti-Arab racist rhetoric, this time targeting Palestinians in occupied Palestine 48. He's already in charge of the so-called Israel Prison Administration, which the Palestinian prisoners were actually able to defeat a few weeks ago in terms of the attacks that Ben-Gvir was attempting to enact against their daily existence. And now he has a new security force that he's in charge of. And all of these are essentially, you know, terrorist brigades in the hands of Ben-Gvir against the Palestinian people. This goes hand in hand with the occupation army. And of course, Ben-Gvir is not alone figure, but Ben-Gvir represents the true face of Zionism in front of the world. When we hear from Itamar Ben-Gvir, we're not hearing from some fringe figure. Instead, we're hearing from someone who has the authority to order and command the police forces of this settler colonial project, which is receiving $3.8 million a year $3.8 billion a year in U.S. aid and U.S. armaments and weaponry. There's no question that Itamar Ben-Gvir is a threat to the Palestinian people and a threat to the entire region, but he's not alone in that regard. He represents what Zionism truly is, that is a racist, colonialist ideology dedicated to the complete dispossession of the Palestinian people and the domination of the region for the interests of imperialism. And so, you know, Ben-Gvir is openly threatening another Nakba against the Palestinian people, and this is one reason why it's so urgent for people everywhere around the world to compel their governments to end their complicity in these ongoing Zionist war crimes against the Palestinian people, you know, by imposing an arms embargo on the occupation, boycotting the occupation, confronting these arms dealers that are selling weapons that are tested on Palestinian lives everywhere around the world.
I'm quickly running out of time here. I'm trying to forge a couple issues into a question for you, Saad. We're seeing condemnations pour in. Obviously, we've had one of the most prominent ones coming from Hamas. Also looking at Jordan, who requested an emergency meeting with the Arab League, which they held. And the Arab League has said the UN should convene. And some of the Arab countries, like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, have sent words of condemnation. Of course, the Islamic Republic has also condemned the act that has occurred there inside the mosque. Are we looking at, and then I have to add to that, the fact that you even have the United States and where Charlotte Cates is, Canada, they've even come out and expressed their worries. I mean, for whatever that's worth. But at the same time, I think because the landscape is different with these politicians that are have been described as fascists, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, like Smotrich, are we going to see anything come out of it? I mean, aside from condemnations, are we going to see them do something before more Palestinian lives are going to be slaughtered?
We've been used now to all these statements and condemnations, and it's verbal work so far. We need to have the Arab world and the Islamic world to do something, you know, tangible, something, you know, they can do and they can afford to do it. For instance, to boycott all companies that works in Israel, or to start making a kind of an economic pressure. They could do that without even bothering to go to war or even anything else. They can put pressure on Europe, for instance, that European, we are not going to buy from any of your companies if they deal with Israel, to bring back the boycott, which used to be in the 60s. And in that case, they do something. But so far, what we hear from the Arab world and the Islamic world, unfortunately, only the condemnations and some statements here and there. Now they are going to convene for the Arab League soon because of that matter. But also we will hear again some condemnation. Palestinians are doing that on their own. We are, as a Palestinian, resisting the occupation, and this is the only way for us to do it. It's important for us, the international position, and I think that this stupid Israeli government is giving us every day, and the whole world every day, evidence that it is a fascist and it's a racist, colonialist regime from the very beginning, since 1948 till today, which based on hatred, violence against the region in general, and particularly against the Palestinians. They are prosecuting an ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, and this ethnic cleansing is continuing since 1947 till today, and it's still going on. So we need the international community to understand that, and the Israeli are providing them every day with evidence. But from our side, as Palestinians, we should not rely and wait for this condemnation, but rather to resist this occupation.
Thank you very much for that. Saad Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University, with his statements from Ramallah. Many thanks. And Charlotte Cates, international coordinator, Semi-Dune Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network from Vancouver. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batawe and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting.
The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadarbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakah.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet, the Messenger of Allah. Imam al-Jawad was also the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, and His Eminence undertook the imamat and the religious leadership of the Muslims after his father's death, the martyrdom of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. As historians have unanimously agreed, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was not more than 7 years old when he undertook the imamat and the religious leadership of the Muslims. Now, this great role of the imamat and the religious and spiritual and political leadership of the Muslims, of course, would not befit a keeper who had the mentality of a child and who was only a mere 7 years old. Because if one is to plunge into the fields of knowledge and wisdom, or enter into any kind of debate or controversies, especially so with great scholars and specialists, the amount of knowledge and wisdom needed must surpass that of even a very aged person. But we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, despite being not more than 7 years old, broke this notion and showed the world that though he was still a child, but because he was a divinely appointed imam on behalf of Allah, he was able to enter the fields of knowledge and wisdom and win in the debates and controversies against great scholars and specialists.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening